What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Alex Svetsky, Sovereign, CEO and founder of Amber App, making Bitcoin easy by stacking stats on autopilot. Author of several seminal and important essays on Bitcoin, liberty, and freedom. The Rise of the Individual, The Fall of the State, Libertarians Are Not Utopians, Bitcoin and Lockdowns, Do Not Buy Bitcoin, Discrimination and Diversity, Why Liberty Matters, In Support of the Elite, Dumb People, and Corona Didn't Cause It. How are you today, Alex?
Doing really well, boys. How we doing?
That's great. You said you were moving. How annoying was that?
Well, it wasn't too bad, man. I was just moving into a new place because I just changed country. So yeah, I'm gonna be here for maybe a month or two before I look to move somewhere else.
Oh wow, sounds like you're a man on the move.
Man on the move, trying to keep as flexible as possible in amongst this the madness that is the backdrop of 2020.
Yeah, what are you seeing out there? I mean, things are moving rapidly.
What am I seeing? What am I not seeing, man? Just, you know, they always say, people think that that tyranny is supposedly done by evil people. But what you know, the reality of it is tyranny is done by the average person who is too stupid to think more than one step deep and is overcome by fear and hysteria. And, you know, they actually support the dissemination of natural rights, by whatever authority they look to for, you know, their veneer of protection. So it's, when I look at how stupid people are, like believing in, you know, some sort of fabric mask is going to somehow protect them. Necessary, you know, things are apparently like going and shopping at retail shops, but you know, the gyms are not necessary, so they're going to shut those down.
Right.
Man, I don't know, man. Like, the world's backwards, and the problem is the sheep support it. I don't know what to think.
Sure.
Anymore.
Well, you know, let's take a look at your article, The Rise of the Individual, The Fall of the State. You know, I think it's a very important article. I really dig it. For myself, I see it as the rise of the individual applying to myself. But I'm not sure I see the fall of the state, you know, at the current moment. And where do you see things on the long curve if you kind of zoom in on 2020? Do you think the state is falling, or do you think it's rising itself?
No, it's been falling for a long time. I mean, the thing is, when I did stunt driving when I was younger, sort of in my mid-20s, and when a car starts to lose control, the natural reaction of a person is to try and grab the steering wheel and try and force it back into, you know, their control. But what they end up doing is they make it worse, and they, you know, they add to the imbalance of the car, and then, you know, they end up flipping the car over. So, you know, the best course of action when something's out of control is to let go, particularly, you know, with a car or with any other complex sort of moving system. Now, what you find is this same sort of natural response by a state that is becoming more fragile and more afraid and more, cumbersome, fatter. You see the reaction by them is, you know, basically spitting propaganda out of every media faucet that they can, spreading, like, literally censoring common sense and, spreading fear and, you know, they're printing money like maniacs. Like, this is sort of the death throes of any large-scale institution, is that it tries to grab on tighter as it's losing control. And then the tighter it grabs, the more it actually loses control. It's kind of like the Streisand effect, you know, is you try and suppress a bit of information, and in the process of suppressing it, you actually popularize it. So So the state is falling. It doesn't, you know, at times it might not look like it's falling because the state is further encroaching. But in doing so, it is actually, it's unraveling itself, because it's going to start to fracture in multiple different ways, because the more you try and, you know, homogenize any sort of complex system that has, you know, inputs and outputs that are so variable, you know, i.e. human fucking beings, who are all different, and you will start to create these sort of outbursts in different places that'll start to bring down the fabric of the entire centralized kind of model that they're trying to create. So yeah, I'm still adamant that the state is falling. The thing is, we just need to lengthen our time horizon. It's not going to be tomorrow. It's not going to be next year, but it's going to happen over the coming decade. And, you know, we're seeing it in its, in all of its panic stricken glory.
Yeah. You know, you always kind of come back to this very interesting quote, hard times create strong men, strong men, mm-hmm. strong men create good times create mm-hmm. weak men, and weak men create hard mm-hmm. times. Where do you think we mm-hmm. are in that parable right now?
We're in the weak men creating hard times, man. Yeah, we're sort of like the chapter three of that, you know, so we're, you know, we're going to come into the hard times that build strong men. And that's sort of where we're in the, in between those two. So, you know, like, it's been pretty fucking good for society, you know, for the last couple of decades.
Right.
And particularly those that are close to the sort of the monetary spigot, they've done really well. And in their stupidity of trying to focus on things like, you know, I mean, there's nothing more dangerous than a person with a good intent who believes that, you know, some sort of utopia is possible, because the only way, like, you can drive for a utopia is to first have the assumption that things should be perfect, that we shouldn't, as human beings, have conflict, that we shouldn't have problems. Like, that those things are fucking natural, because we live in a real world of, you know, within a framework of uncertainty, of scarce finite time, and of scarce and finite resources, and there will always be interpersonal conflict because we are human beings, and trying to remove that from society via some ridiculous utopian ideal, like, oh, we should all be happy, or there should always be peace, you actually bring about a dystopia. Utopias cannot exist. And, you know, what we've had is, you know, good times where so much wealth has been created that, you know, you have a group of idiots, you know, and whether it's a conspiracy that, you know, there's some Bilderbergs, like, you know, Alex Jones might want to have you believe, or whether it's just the classic, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, you know, it doesn't matter. Like, the result is the same, is that you have these utopians who believe that somehow they can make society perfect, and in doing so, want to kill the very nature of life, which is this this kind of, you know, messy, free, liberal, conflicting kind of process. But that's the beauty of life. That's the beauty of freedom. That's the beauty of liberty. And they want to basically remove that from society, remove that from humanity, so we can have this clean, sterile, sanitized, so-called fucking utopia, which in my mind is the ultimate dystopia. So that's why, you know, this cycle happens, is you've got idiots who are born who had it good, who think that they can make it perfect, and perfection is the lowest ideal because it cannot exist.
Right. You know, yeah, you continue on about this in your Libertarians Are Not Utopians article, where you talk about how the current incarnation of the nation state is a modern experiment, and the idea of public property managed by elected officials with no skin in the game is a modern concoction and will tear itself apart because it is unlike mm-hmm. anything else in the natural world. Mm-hmm. And yeah, this is kind of a new idea to me, you know, or kind of taking the horizon of nation states much further. I just kind of always accepted nation states, and I think most people do. And this idea of nation states managing public property is an interesting way of putting it. What do you make of sort of what do you see in politics right now? And I'm not trying to get political, but, you know, where on the left, maybe they, you know, like Bernie Sanders and AOC. And sort of, yeah, I mean, this movement.
I mean, look, it's they're all the same, just a different level of derangement, man. That's really the only difference, is that We are human beings, and all species on the planet actually are biologically wired to respect territory and to respect territorial bounds. In fact, that's how nature maintains equilibrium. You know, I was reading a brilliant book a little while back. I can't remember the name of it, but I'll if I remember later, I'll give it to you for the show notes. But it's an anthropologist who looks at how throughout all of natural and biological history, the way nature evolved was through creating territorial boundaries species all respect. So private property is not some cultural man-made ideal. It's actually it's a biological imperative. It's within us. Now, when you take society and you sort of build it from first principles from a standpoint of private property, you then start to respect the three, you know, pillars of reality, which are scarce resources, scarce time, scarce energy, and let's call it four pillars. What the hell's the fourth one? And just general uncertainty of the future. We do not know the future. So when you take those things, it's only through the respect of private property that we're able to trade amongst each other in a way that is multiplicative. It's additive. Like we can produce more together. Whereas the alternative is to basically, which is what's happened, particularly in the last couple hundred years with the rise of the nation state, is this idea that a caretaker who has no skin in the game, so there's no private property there, there's no disincentive for doing the wrong thing, where they represent the will of everybody, irrespective of what the individuals may or may not want themselves. And what you get then is basically a raping and pillaging of natural resources, a raping and pillaging of people's private property, of their time, of their energy, of their wealth, of all of these things, because there is no repercussion for the representative that is running that. Now, when we go back in time, and this is why, you know, I sort of, Seyfedin has argued this recently with Alex Gladstein, and I 100% on Seyfedin's side, is that monarchies, for example, was far superior to the idea of a democratic republic or the modern kind of nation state that we had, because the monarch themselves was effectively a private property owner, and they had to have a lower time preference because it was their land that they were trying to pass on to their children. Now, if they were a shit monarch, their family didn't last long and was quickly overtaken because they didn't build up the capital to maintain their strength. Whereas in the public sphere, what we have today is that it doesn't, you're only in for 4 years, maybe 8 years, maybe 12 years. And your incentive is to deplete the capital for current earnings. And that is a high time preference attitude. And that's where the incentive is. And so you have to be like a really, 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 really powerful, you know, great leader to try and think long term instead of short term. But the problem is, when you think long term and you take actions that are long term, they don't produce fruit in the short term. So what happens from a political standpoint is that people get fucking pissed off and they want you out. So fundamentally, you cannot have a public political system, because everything turns into a tragedy of the commons. We burn through all our resources, we burn through all our wealth, we burn through all our capital, and we basically we hollow out the society that the principles of private property helped us build the capital for in the first place. So this is where we are today. We're 200 years in of this sort of this replacement of private property by public property and public law, and we're starting to see the whole thing tear itself apart. You know, we're depleting resources left, right, and center because we've got no accurate allocation of any resources, whether human resources or physical resources. And you know, it's just a blind fucking scramble to sell the future for today, and that cannot last.
Yeah,
it cannot last. It's going to fall apart.
It's very interesting. You know, you also speak about in the rise of the individual that the most important tool of our time, aka money, the ultimate resource, and make it uninflatable, uncensorable, and unfuckwittable. Money has now become an unforgeable form of data that no one can control or manipulate. Money is the battlefield. It seems to me like the American project, and correct me if I'm wrong, is really important in your thinking.
Yeah. So the American project was actually the first attempt at, how can I say, moving away. So it's a really interesting one. So we had this sort of tyrannical, you know, monarchic kind of state, and then, you know, as the monarchy started to build, you know, public institutions, the monarchy became more and more corrupt because it built sort of bureaucracies around it, which then built their own monopolies around the monarch, and then started to, you know, push, you know, peddle this idea of, you know, democracy, which is you know, which is a, I call it a majoritarian scam. So so what was interesting was you had these Americans English people who left for America to start a new thing, which was not about democracy. It was about private property, and it was about capitalism. And that's where sort of America emerged. And in that first 100 years, America went from nothing, from a fucking barren land, to the largest, wealthiest nation on the planet in 100 years, versus these, you know, kingdoms that had been around for hundreds, like they'd been around for centuries and in some cases millennia, and it overtook them in that short period of time. Now, the momentum that had, and the spirit of capitalism in America sort of, you know, lived on, but, you know, after the, you know, Lincoln sort of came in and, you know, brought America together, so, you know, quote unquote, united it and removed the ability for states to secede. You know, things started to, you know, spiral out of control there. And then things really started to go downhill when you had Woodrow Wilson come in and, you know, add the American forces to the dismemberment of the European monarchies, for, you know, this idea of a democratic republic at that point. And then from then on, it's, you know, you've had these two forces of, you know, strong technological advancement, which, you know, is a deflationary force, which is a value add force, alongside monetary inflation and the expansion of the public edifice. And they've sort of been, you know, the technological advancement has been so strong that it's kind of made room for the public parasite to build long enough. But now, you know, we've basically stalled from a technological advancement perspective. You know, we've done a shitload of stuff from, you know, in the bits space. We've done fuck all in the atoms space, and we're, you know, the state is basically, you know, the public parasite is running out of resources to capture, and it's, you know, it's gripping at straws, and it's gripping tighter to whatever it's got left in it, and it's not going to be pretty. So coming back to your original point about America being really important, is America was libertarian and it was a private property capitalist institution or idea. Let's not call it an institution, it was an idea in the beginning, and that's what propelled America in the beginning. It's just unfortunate that, I mean, like I said, that spirit is still there in many ways, but unfortunately, the public behemoth that is, you know, the Democratic Republic has sort of, you know, suffocated the, you know, what made America great in the first place.
Yeah, it seems like, or at least part of my take on it is that, you know, the project has turned inward and it's no longer feasting outward, and it's feasting on its own. And it seems like most nation states are like that right now. Obviously, I'm assuming you had the ability to emigrate to America in the way that you're moving around now, even if it's short term. I don't know if that assumption is correct, but it seems like you've chosen not to come to America.
No, I never had the ability to emigrate there. No. That, like, because I've always been like an Australian citizen. But yeah, like I mean,
like, would you be able to come here for a month? And it seems like you've chosen to go somewhere else for a month or two.
I would love to, but at the moment I don't think I can, because it's closed off to basically just about everyone.
So does America still call to you in that regard? Not that anywhere calls to you, but is it still something that's an appealing option to you in the current environment of nation states?
Look, in some ways it does, man, because I know that, like I said, that spirit still exists in America, like that libertarian spirit, and you know that. I mean, it originally, like, that form of thinking, like that idea of, you know, private property was really sort of emerged in Austria, you know, in the 1800s, and sort of that center of gravity shifted after the fall of the Austro-Hungarian Empire in World War I, and it kind of shifted over to America. And the people who sort of led that then were your Rothbards and your Hans Hermann Hoppers and your Hayeks and your Milton Friedmans and all of that. So basically, the spirit of sanity, the spirit of that stuff, kind of still exists in America, and there is like a still a strong, you know, libertarian sort of spirit over there. And I mean, a lot of the work and a lot of the thinking that's been done has, you know, been primarily in English as well. It's still kind of the you know, I have hope for that. But I mean, I don't know. I still think America needs to be the disunited states of America. You know, we need, you know, America should be 50 states, not one fucking nation. And you know, the sooner that happens, the better. But I don't know. I still definitely have a calling for America. But it's I mean, I kind of wish that I was born 200 years ago in some ways, because you know, that would have been the America you want to be a part of. But hey, you know, we've got Bitcoin now, so it's like a this is America 2.0, the way I see it.
It's interesting. I mean, I've been fortunate enough to visit Australia. I don't know about your feelings now about Australia, but I was there about, I don't know, 20 years ago. I loved it, and I saw it as sort of like a sm not a smaller American project. Small is not the right word, but a less populated America.
Yeah,
Like just
in
behind
some ways.
demographically in numbers, but in some ways just more exciting. Like I would go to a town like Byron Bay, and I was like, wow, this is San Diego 100 years ago. And everything was wide open. So I'm curious, do you miss Australia? And Sydney, I think you're from outside of Sydney, is just a magnificent city to me.
Yeah, look, it's beautiful, but like Australia's kind of been like, you know, they've called it the lucky country for God knows how long, and I think it's just been because it's been so far away from conflict and all that sort of stuff. But you know, I call it the ignorant country, because it's like they haven't really had too much hardship to live through, and as a result, they're kind of ignorant to how easy it is for tyranny to kind of come through. So like things like, you know, Australia was one of the first countries to pass the anti-encryption bill, to sort of, you know, to force companies to build, you know, back doors, or to force them to give information on, you know, private citizens to police without warrants and stuff. Like, it's just a crazy shit, man. So like, you know, that you've seen all the crap that's happening with Melbourne, with, you know, this sort of push for mandatory vaccination, and you know, there's some laws that passed in Western Australia and South Australia where they can come and take your kids for like, I think, up to 6 weeks if they think that you've got corona or something. It's like wild stuff going on
Yeah,
that
why do you think Australia is taking it a step further, or I mean, is it a rolling out sort of testing ground for what they're going to do in the UK, Canada, and America?
who knows? It could be, maybe that's the most docile crowd out there, the ones who are least willing to push back. You know, where the social safety net feels good, you know, feels large enough that, you know, or it's the one where, you know, the government's never been, you know, historically tyrannical, where, you know, people just trust that, oh, the government will do the right thing for me, right? So it's like there's a first time for everything, and Australia hasn't really had a first time tyranny. So, you know, it's very easy again. And again, I don't say that as like some, you know, evil Hitler guy sort of rises up. Like in the beginning, Hitler wasn't, you know, his goal wasn't just to fucking nuke a bunch of people. Sorry, not nuke, but, you know, put a bunch of people in concentration camps. That happened over time, as, you know, the intensity of, you know, what they wanted to do increased. So it's you know, today it's like, oh yeah, for your safety, you know, you have to stay inside. Tomorrow it's for your safety, you have to take a vaccine. And you know, the next day it's like, you know, if you don't want to take a vaccine for your safety, you're going to be imprisoned for the safety of others. So it's like it's a very, you know, very slippery slope. And the way it's always positioned is, you know, for safety and for the good of the community. And this is again why I hate the idea of collectivism, which is why, you know, I always say collectivism is a cancer, is that when you replace the rights of the real individual with the imaginary rights of the imaginary collective, yeah, it's when tyranny comes in. And the thing is, Australia's sort of been, and Australians have been sold this lie that, you know, it's she'll be right, you know, we're all in this together, and all this bullshit, which is how you slip into a tyrannical sort of dictatorship without fucking noticing. And that's the thing that, you know, why perhaps Australia is, you know, one of the places where it might happen first, is that it may not even be a conspiracy. It may not be, you know, a quote unquote testing ground for, you know, tyrannical maniacs to do stuff. It may just be that the idiots have had it so good there that they think they can bring about a utopia for the safety and for the good of the people. Like, yeah. And in the process, destroy what made the society function in the first place, which is the empowerment of the individual.
Yeah. You know, you have another interesting article, Discrimination and Diversity. And I have to admit, while preparing for the show, I was reading through all your blog posts, and I saw for the second time, the Shark Tank one. And I did go and revisit Shark Tank.
Oh, yeah, that's an old one. Yeah, okay,
man.
Yeah.
I did go and revisit. And, you know, it's interesting. I learned a lot by touching off from that point. Maybe I knew this before, I didn't remember, but you dropped out of uni at like 19 and took your scholarship money and just put it in the market and made bank. Mm-hmm. Then you lost it all and worked your way back. Mm-hmm. I'm curious with you know, this kind of combining that with growing up in Australia, and how did growing up in Australia kind of frame your outlook on diversity and discrimination?
Well, I mean, I kind of say that those two things. So when I wrote that article, the diversity and discrimination, I just kind of talk about it, how you got these clowns who are running around who are, you know, SJW, you know, social justice warrior, woke idiots, who sit there and say, oh, discrimination is bad, but diversity is good. And I'm like, well, you can't have diversity without discriminating, you idiot. So it's like they come together, and, you know, like what they do is they run around without defining anything and without thinking deeply about what it actually means that they're saying. So what I try to push in that article is this idea that, hey, discrimination is actually fundamental to human beings' ability to, like, the word comes from the word discern. To be able to judge what is right and wrong for you on an individual basis. Now, you should be free to apply your judgment, your ability to discern what you want, what you don't want, what you think is good, what you don't think is good, to anything you want. It doesn't matter, as long as if you apply your discrimination to an individual, as long as you're not aggressing against them in the process. In which case, if you aggress against them, they have the right to protect themselves and, you know, aggress back to neutralize that aggression. Now, what the point that I was trying to get to with it is that if we remove the ability for anybody to discriminate, you know, on whatever stupid law they tried to say, it's like, oh, you know, you're not allowed to discriminate because someone's black, then you're not allowed to discriminate because of their gender, then this, then that, then that's a snowball effect, which comes to the point where, you know, you can't discriminate about anything. So then what happens is people become this homogenous fucking blob where we're all the same, where we all think alike, where it's just one big fat echo chamber where there is no more diversity. So guess what? By eliminating discrimination, you've eliminated diversity. And when you eliminate diversity, you actually, again, you deviate from how nature functions. Nature functions because it discriminates, because it's diverse. And you have this whole complex, chaotic system of life, which is what life is by definition. Life is not supposed to be clean and sterile. You know, sterilization is the opposite of life. You know, life is this messy, organic, natural process of discovery, which requires, you know, as much diversity as possible to make sure it's robust and anti-fragile. So when you remove that diversity, when you remove that ability to discern, to discriminate, you create this, you basically create USSR, which, you know, fell apart, or you create this kind of you know, homogenous bubble of soulless individuals that are no longer different. There's no longer any flavor in humanity anymore. It's like drones. So that's kind of what I was trying to push for that. So I don't know how to tie that back to Australia, except that, I mean, Australia is very multicultural in that sense. Like, you know, yeah, it's primarily primarily built by immigrants, I guess, to a large degree.
Well, you know, as a visitor, it was a very interesting place to me. I mean, I think it's beautiful. It was wonderful. But I felt like, especially in Sydney, I felt tension between different groups. I felt like maybe Aboriginals were suppressed. And not that they should be one thing or the other. And I was just trying to compare it to my experiences back home. And then I was on my way to New Zealand. And I wonder, you know, because you come from a diverse background. And Australia is a melting pot. And I just wonder, you know, how much that impacted your views on, I don't know if you experienced discrimination or not. And I was just curious. And, you know, it was interesting going back to that Shark Tank video. You just see, I mean, incredibly successful, confident person who, from what it seemed like to me, though, it seemed like you were, after that, maybe spending a lot of your 20s trying lots of different things and really enjoying the ride. And that, like, somewhere along the line, you, when you get to Bitcoin, like, everything gets super focused on this tool. And now we're talking about freedom and liberty all the time.
Yeah. So, okay, let's touch on a few things then. So yes, in Australia, it's a melting pot. You know, there's all sorts of different cultures and stuff like that. There's always tension between the cultures because, you know, they're different, and that's a good thing. Tension, and again, the tension and discrimination is a good thing. You don't want everyone to be the same. So, you know, like in Australia, you've got the Lebs, you know, don't like the Vietnamese, don't like fucking the white people, don't like this, don't like that. But there's nothing wrong with that because, you know, they sort of, like, when you have a constant tension, it kind of keeps violence at bay. But when you try and force integration, you end up creating like this subliminal fucking resentment. And that's when you start to, like, you either create the subliminal resentment, which blows up in a bigger way later, or what's, I believe, even worse is that these different people and these different groups give up what made them unique in the first place. They give up their culture, they give up their, you know, their values, they give up their you know, their patterns, which are unique to them, and they all start to look the same, sound the same, behave the same, and you kill the life out of society. So yeah, when I was younger, you know, I got called a wog, which is kind of like, you know, similar to fresh off the boat, like, you know, all that sort of stuff. And even though I was born in Australia, but like, we kind of, like, you know, instead of me complaining about it and being a fucking victim and participating in the oppression Olympics where, oh, look at me, I've been, you know, discriminated against, I took that. And I, you know, I let it energize me. I'm like, yeah, fuck it, I'm a wog, you know, and I'm gonna make it a cool thing. And that's what a lot of, you know, kids, particularly in my sort of generation, like, sort of, you know, from a couple years younger than me, so sort of, you know, born in the probably born in the early 80s through to, you know, the 90s, maybe the early 90s. So there was a decade of us there who didn't, you know, we didn't take that shit, you know, rolling over. We didn't sit there and scream and bitch and whine about being called, you know, a name. We kind of took it on and we embraced it and we, you know, we made it cool. And, you know, we developed our own little culture out of it. And that was cool. And again, that's how you build strength. You don't focus on being a victim. You know, you focus on, you know, using things to fuel you. And for me, that's always been, you know, a big thing for me. Like, I've never wanted to be a victim. And I think that's also one of the big drivers for me, having always, you know, pursued entrepreneurial, you know, pursuits, like, right. You know, that, so, like, you know, I've always tried to create things as opposed to waiting for somebody else to give it to me. So I've always, you know, believed in this, you know, idea of personal responsibility, you know, as the only way forward. You know, I've lost many times, I've gained a few times, and sort of, like, it's all evened out over the years. You know, there's things that I wish I didn't do, but, you know, they sort of helped me learn and helped set the frame for me to be ready to be the person that I am today. And, like, Shark Tank was an interesting experience for me because, you know, that was my mentor at the time was like, look, you're going on a show which has no value for the business. It's just entertainment value. And I was young and stupid, and I thought, hey, that's gonna get us on, you know, national television. It's gonna be great for the business. And I got made a fool out of because, you know, the whole thing was basically set up in the beginning. Like, before I even walked in, they were like, okay, so you're gonna say you're like a shark going into the shark. So they gave me this script to make me look even more arrogant. And then, you know, I went in there basically for an hour. Then they chopped it down to obviously 10 minutes to the parts that made me look like more of a fool. But hey, you know, again, I wish I never did that in some ways, but at the same time, also glad I did, because I know at some stage, in some way, shape or form, I'll deal with the media again and I won't be tricked again in that capacity to make myself look like a fool, you know, when it really matters. So it's, you know, all of these things, like, I guess, culminated. So, you know, being an entrepreneur, you know, not being a victim, you know, learning responsibility from a young age, learning to sort of like, I've never had a paycheck. So like for me to feed myself, always had to make something or do something or create something. So these ingredients like really helped when it came time for me to stumble onto Bitcoin, to understand that there was a couple other things as well, sort of, you know, having lost everything in the stock market, I learned about markets. And I also learned a little bit about, like, you know, I was a gold silver bug in 2011, 2012. Mm. So that sort of, you know, I learned about, you know, the idea of hard money and, you know, money printing and QE and all this sort of stuff. So I had all these ingredients sort of all randomly came together as I stumbled on Bitcoin, and just like those things clicked into place. So in many ways, what I tell people is, like, I think my life was, you know, this mishmash of shit, which, you know, looking back on it doesn't make much sense at all. Like, I've been across so many different industries, across so many random things, studied so many different things, like, it's, and none of it sort of has a coherent pattern until I fall over and stumble onto Bitcoin, and then everything starts to be like, oh fuck, that's useful, oh that's useful, oh that's useful, oh that thing I learned there, oh math, oh physics, oh this or that, like philosophy. Like, I was reading, you know, books on philosophy when I was a 13-year-old kid. Why? Like, it had no resemblance to any of the other shit I did, but, you know, all these things sort of started to fall into place. And that's why, you know, I say to people, like, Bitcoin is the thing, like my, the next chapter of my life, like the next 10, 20 years, however long this chapter is going to be, is literally about Bitcoin. Like, it's like the tool that embodies, you know, the values that I've forged for my own life through all the experience that I've been in. So it's a powerful thing.
Yeah, man. I've seen a lot of what I've kind of get a lot of out of your writing, and it is very powerful, is, but there's this push and pull dynamic, and the push is, I'm going to tell you all about Bitcoin and liberty and freedom and what it can do. And the pull is kind of like, I'm not going to pull you here though. You know, I'll show you how to fish, but I'm not going to fish for you. Do you think the word is getting out? Do you think more people are talking about money and the tool of money and what Bitcoin can do for us? Do you think it's kind of like you're just getting, you're kind of getting one at a time and we'll just take who we can get? Do you think things are moving quickly?
Look, that's a hard one. So in the beginning, I was very pushed, like, you know, so I was doing all these articles and really trying to, like, push people into Bitcoin and, like, recently, more particularly with that, you would have noticed, like, the don't buy Bitcoin article.
Yeah, I love
article.
It.
Yeah, so I was like, you know what? Fuck you guys. Like, I'm not gonna beg anymore. Like, you want it, it's here. If you don't, if you want to stay ignorant, well, you know, that's your choice too. You can stay ignorant, and, you know, don't come crying later when you're poor, because, you know, the shit money that you saved up, you know, can't buy your fucking cup of coffee. So, that's kind of a more recent attitude for me, and it actually emerged. I mean, it's emerged for multiple reasons. One, because I've just, you know, drained after, like, sitting there trying to convince so many people and just having it thrown in my face, basically. Also, I was listening to a podcast with or to a lecture by Jordan Peterson talking, you know, about this idea of don't cast pearls before swine, which is, you know, it's a biblical reference, and it's such a important notion, is that, you know, there's, you can spend your energy on the ones that count, and that's sort of what I'm coming around to more so. And, you know, I think it's also reflected in the recent article that I did about Bitcoin and lockdowns, is that, you know, the existing status quo, the existing institutions and all that stuff, it's unraveling, man. Like, you know, no longer does money represent your effort and your labor. It's if you ask Stephanie Kelton, it's just some fucking random points on a pointless scorecard. You know, it's like 2 + 2 = 151. Like, it doesn't matter anymore. Like, it's just made up shit, right? So money no longer represents that. You know, your savings no longer matter. Like, you know, they're just gonna, inflate the shit out of it, so you no longer can save. And you know, now they're going to bring in new laws like a stupid travel rule and all this stuff where you're not even allowed to spend your own money where you want to. You got to ask permission for that shit, and everyone, you know, everyone's going to be imposing know your customer. So all these things are happening. So what's going to happen is, you know, people at some point, you know, like the pain is going to ratchet up enough where they're going to be like, fuck, what else is out there? Right. And guess what? There's Bitcoin out there. And, you know, it's the only thing that's going to stand the test of time. And it's this, you know, it's this Noah's Ark. Like, I always come back to this idea that it's a fucking ark. And it's, you know, that there is going to be a massive influx of people wanting some sort of, you know, protection of wealth, or, you know, accurate measurement of their wealth, or ability to transact without some asshole in the way telling them what they can and cannot do with the product of their own labor. And that's why I'm kind of not too concerned. Is as much as we need to push it forward, I mean, the clown show that is the state is unraveling things so quickly that they're going to push people into Bitcoin inadvertently by making life worse for everyone.
Yeah. It's interesting, yeah. In your Bitcoin and Lockdowns article, you talk about curiosity versus pain. And, you know, I guess we're the curious, and a lot more people are going to come through the pain. And you have this quote, the last 5 billion to adopt Bitcoin will likely take as long as the first 5 million did.
Yeah.
What do you think? Sorry,
you go ask the question.
No, you go.
No, I was gonna say that just hit me as I was writing. That's all.
Got it.
I was like, yeah. Was that gonna be a question or?
No. I was wondering what do you think you'd be doing if Bitcoin didn't exist?
Shit, man. I don't know. Like I really don't know. I reckon I'd be joining some fucking mercenary group to fight for freedoms or something. I really don't know. But look, most likely I would probably be like one of the Silicon Valley dweebs, like, you know, building random tech things because I thought that was the right thing to do. So I'd probably, yeah, most likely be deep into the entrepreneurial space.
Right. Where do you want to be in 20 years without Bitcoin in the framework? Like what would be something like you'd look back on and be like, I'm glad I did that for the last 20 years, or I want that to be my legacy.
Without Bitcoin or with Bitcoin?
Let's include with Bitcoin.
Okay. Look, in 20 years time, I sort of want to be working on building, building new private cities, to be honest. That's sort of like my long-term plan is once I build up Amber, and you know, if all goes well, and if I can exit the company, you know, at a decent multiple, you know, my intention then is going to be like, basically I'll take all the money, put it into Bitcoin, you know, sit on it. I want to spend probably a couple of years just in the quiet, just writing. I have a bunch of books. Like I basically got the outline and the contents for about 20 books that I want to write. 2-0, yes. So there's a lot there that I want to get out, and I want to kind of combine, you know, just principles from different fields. And the four fields in particular that I want to combine is economics, philosophy, psychology, and anthropology. And those four just topics, I just find so many overlaps, and so like kind of like this ability to come to, you know, the truth of life and creation through the understanding of the you know, all of those different concepts. So I'd like to do that, but, you know, re-emerging from that, you know, 5-10 years from now, I'd like to start thinking about how to build private cities and how to, you know, bring back, you know, private property rights against the backdrop of what I'm sure is going to be quite a non-functional, tyrannical type, you know, set of states that are either running out of resources, that are poorly, you know, that aren't operating properly, that have, you know, people wanting to get the fuck out of there. So it's going to be yeah, like if I look back on 20 years is definitely, yeah, a long time, man, but I think that's what we need to be doing 20 years from now. And I don't know if that was exactly a question, or like, what would I be proud of looking back on it? Or is that more a question?
Yeah, it's more of a question of like, what are you trying to get out of your life? You know, and what would make you satisfied looking back?
That I
And I ask because you seem to have a tremendous amount of energy, and you're putting a lot out there, and you're driving really fast, really hard. And I'm like, where is this going for Alex?
Yeah.
Because I get a lot of I get a lot of singularity out of your work, and I think that's very that's powerful, and that's good. But I'm trying to get more of the story.
Yeah. So when I was younger, I was really ambitious, and I wanted to be, you know, at different points in time, I wanted to be like famous for different reasons. So I wanted to be, you know, at one point I wanted to be an actor, then, you know, another point I wanted to be like a world famous, you know, entrepreneur. So, you know, like my idol when I was younger was Steve Jobs. You know, I really, really have a lot of respect for that man. You know, then I wanted to sort of, I think they were probably the two big ones. I think these days, like, you know, those sort of fantasies have kind of lessened for me. Like the entrepreneurial one, you know, I've still got a bit of passion for that. But I've always wanted to be remembered for someone who did something great. Now, I think at this point in time, the greatest thing one can do is spread good ideas. And what I seem to be converging on is to be some sort of, you know, or to be remembered as like a person who spoke truth during a time of madness. And, you know, whether that truth is found through podcasts that people listen to down the track, whether it's found through videos that I've done myself, and most probably importantly for me is going to be people who found my writings and my work. And that's kind of why I really want to do something there. And if I can also, like, through, I guess, my entrepreneurial expression of my passion that is Bitcoin, in other words, Amber, if I can also be remembered for someone who helped, you know, onboard a bunch of people into Bitcoin in the early days, I think that's also got a profound thing for me. So yeah, in many ways, like, I want to be remembered, and I want to look back and say that, you know, I had the integrity and the fortitude and the courage to, you know, to stay consistent and to stay true, no matter how stupid society got and how deranged it became. You know, I'm not perfect. I'm 100% going to make mistakes along the way. I'm going to do things that I regret, but I want my overall direction to be consistent, and consistent with, you know, the values that I think are, you know, aligned with how, you know, natural law functions. So, man.
One of the things I pull from your writing, one of the many things, is, you know, Bitcoin is non-political, non-sovereign. And what I'm connecting here is that maybe that platform, that non-sovereign, non-political platform, provides, you know, a monetary platform where we don't have to fight over the money via our differences. And I wonder what you think of that. Because I just think that's...
We can trade, like, so in other words, like, instead of beating each other up and, you know, and enriching ourselves through the theft of another, you know, when you know the cost of theft is high and the price of defense is low, you know, the incentive changes such that you want to trade and exchange with those who are different to you, and then you enrich both of, but you know, you enrich each other instead, and that's, I think, like, is that getting to what you just asked then, or?
Yeah, you know, getting back to the hard times quote, I really vacillate on this one, you know, where we are in it, because I wonder, maybe Satoshi thought that he was going through the hard times and providing the solution. And that's my hopeful take on it, because maybe these are the hard times. I, you know, I waffle because maybe these are the soft times and, you know, we are where we are. But I'm hopeful that 10 years ago, someone else thought they were going through the hard times and we're moving through it now. And I wonder, you know, looking at it from that perspective, and I want to know from yours, like, do you care about the current U.S. election? Because the American Project is such a important thing to us. I'm not sure if the U.S. election, though, this current one, is important to you within the framework of the American Project.
It actually is. You know, I mean, you know, people who are listening to this and who sort of follow me on Twitter, they'll know that I've been very pro-Trump throughout the whole period. I think I've even made a couple bets actually for, you know, Trump beating Biden. And for me, that's the way I see it is, as much as, you know, Trump gets, you know, hate for all sorts of things, I actually think, you know, of all the people that have ever been politicians, he's sort of probably the one with a little bit more skin in the game than any of the other public servants have ever had. So I think he's actually, you know, the best thing that could happen for America in the current frame of the Democratic Republic. So within the corrupt system that it is, he is the best choice by fucking far, but better than, you know, the dumbass Kanye, better than, way better than Biden, better than Obama, like better than all that garbage that is out there. So I think it's really important. I think what it does though, is that it's not like, I still don't believe that, you know, the American state in its current form can last. I think there's you know, it's gonna fragment. But I think what Trump does is he really shifts the like the momentum that we've had over the last, you know, few decades in particular towards globalization and sort of this idea of one global government. He really is a fucking thorn in the side of all of that. And in doing that, he actually he raises the incentive for all other nation states to start going internal as well, and to focus on their own shit, and fix their own sort of house, get their own room in order before they deal with anyone else's. And I think that's going to change the incentive back towards, you know, moving the pendulum away from globalism, which is exactly what we need, because the more we move to globalism, the more we, you know, move towards, you know, this dystopian, tyrannical sort of future. So Trump in that sense is very good, because he's going to start the pendulum swinging in the opposite direction and start, you know, moving us back onto the path towards localization. And it's going to happen, you know, less destructively, because the other option is that we end up, you know, with a moron like fucking Biden in there. You know, they sort of sell the last of America's soul and strength to, you know, global, you know, organizations like the WEF and the WHO and all that sort of fucking garbage. And we start to sort of be governed, you know, under this whole, you know, the new reset, or, you know, the new world order, whatever the fuck people want to call it these days. And that, you know, starts to get, you know, larger and larger, more and more powerful. And then, but the thing is, that will collapse under its own weight, because, you know, it becomes more and more fragile the larger it gets. Like, you can't, you know, those kind of systems will always break, no matter how good or smart they think they are. You know, reality, humanity, and organic systems are too complex for any sort of centrally managed system to subsist for long enough. Now, the downside of going down that path is that collapse will be extremely painful, violent, and I mean, even the path along the way for, you know, anyone who believes in sovereignty and individuality, you know, we're going to have a hard fucking time. So at least with Trump getting in, the momentum is sort of like we steer away from, we avert a major, major, major potential crisis. And we then, the individualists and the libertarians and the people who believe in, you know, private property and, you know, and individual freedom and liberties, we can actually then fight to keep the momentum going towards further and further localization and fragmentation, which is, you know, the only thing that'll save us. So I actually think this is an extremely important thing. I think Trump will save the last of, you know, whatever's left of the American spirit. I really fucking hope that he wins.
All right. What's the other side of the coin, though? I'm not a political pollster, so I have no idea who's going to win. But what's the other side of the coin for you if Trump loses?
Like I said, it's Biden wins and we go towards a, you know, global world order kind of thing. You know, that's the potential disaster. Like, if Trump does not win, America will have the last of its strength sold off. You know, basically we're looking at a world of a global credit system of what it looks like in China today.
Is the end game the same? Are they both just accelerationists then, or are there different end games via this political construct?
Who Trump and Biden, you mean? Or?
Yeah.
Okay, so you might have misheard me in the beginning. When I was describing all of that in the beginning, I wasn't describing Trump. I was describing if Biden got in, that's what would happen. If Trump gets in, I think we move away from that. So I think we move away from, a China-style social credit system. I think we move away from a global regime. I think we move away from funding these, shitty organizations like the WEF, like the, the WHO, the World Economic Forum, right. Whatever they are. So I think Trump stands in the way of that. And that's why I think he's good by far.
Okay. So if it seems like there's a strong movement by, free and libertarian thinkers away from global government.
Yes.
And how do we frame that though with like Bitcoin? Because I see Bitcoin as like global money. Mm-hmm. So on one hand, we want to move away from globalism. And mm-hmm. on the other hand, maybe we want to move towards globalism.
It's not globalism. So globalism, see, globalism is this idea that, the globe is better run by, academics and the leaders who, instead of people leading their own countries, it should all be run centrally
right.
through, major central banks and, these so-called, organizations that are supposedly going to look after the world, the IMF and all that bullshit. So that's what globalism represents, and that's a really fucking bad idea. So Bitcoin empowers individuals but allows us to communicate globally. Mm. And that's very, 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 yeah. very different, because you can't concentrate power with Bitcoin. It's impossible. So that's the real change there. And then what happens is, when you empower individuals, you actually start to fragment society. And that's what we want. We want more fragmentation and we want more localization. Because when you have localization, it's your communities and the people around you that become more important. Then you start to create, you create prosperity in each localized region. You then create more trade, you create better use of the resources in the local region, you then can protect private property better. All this sort of stuff starts to flourish when things are more fragmented and localized, as opposed to them being these large-scale, homogenous fucking mandates and ideas and governments that are, mandates and ideas that are passed by these homogenous fucking governments that want to be the caretaker for all 7 billion people, who are fundamentally all fucking different.
Right.
Like you can't do that.
Yeah. No, I see what you're saying. This has been awesome. I really enjoyed jamming with you, Alex.
100%, man.
Yeah, man. Is there anything else you want to cover?
Look, man, I guess I haven't done a pod for a little while. I mean, I've got, I guess one thing, if, whoever's listening to this, definitely check out some of those articles, but I've got a big thing that I'm working on at the moment. A couple of things. One is I'm writing another one called "Resistance Is Not Futile," and the idea of it is going to be to inspire people. It's going to be a fiery article, kind of like "Rise of the Individual, Fall of the State," and it's going to the idea is to empower people to speak up, against stupidity and to speak up against madness, like all of this hysteria that we're seeing with Corona and lockdowns and everything like that. Right. So there's that, but then more importantly, I'm working on Bitcoin Times edition 3, and Rise of the Individual, Fall of the State was from edition 2. Mm. Edition 3 is going to have, me, Jeff Booth, Giacomo Zucco, Parker Lewis, Jimmy Song and Eric Casson in it. It's going to be some really, really, really good pieces, man. So
that's
that
awesome.
I'm going to try and get out by the end of this month, by the end of November, so people should keep an eye out for that.
That's really cool. We're going to talk to Jimmy Song in a little bit.
Awesome.
I implore everyone to check out your articles on Medium. I think it's dope, and to Stack Sats on Amber, and let everyone else know where they could find you.
It's sweet, man. So on Twitter, just Alex Svetsky. My name is spelled a little bit different, Alex, then Svetsky is Svetsky. My Medium is just svetsky.medium.com. That's really the two places that I am most. I'm going to be doing more of these podcasts in the coming weeks. I think I've got one coming up with McCormack. We're going to be debating a couple of things about sort of democracy, collectivism, statism, and all that sort of crap.
Sure. Sweet. I'll check that out.
Yeah, man. And then I think other than that, Amber's available in Australia at the moment. And There's a, you know, I may have a surprise with respect to coming to the US soon. So yeah, we'll
that'd be great.
See how that pans out.
We'll stack those sats in Australia on Amber. This has been dope. I really appreciate it. Peace.
Thanks, brother. Appreciate it. Thanks.
Alex Svetsky, man on the move, going full sovereign right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And thank you for listening. If you dug the show, please vote with your thumbs and press those 5 stars. That's the best way to spread the word. This is Cedric. Peace.